Idolatry sounds like such a scary word, but the truth is we all have idols that we put between us and God. We're going to talk about what some of those things could be and how to get rid of them on this week's episode of the Tower Hill Podcast. Hey everyone, welcome to the podcast of Tower Hill Church. This is Pastor Jason. Hope that you are having a great day. As we get ready to dive into this week's message, just a couple of things we're looking forward to and want to make sure that you know about is this weekend, if you're listening in real time, this weekend, October 1st, Sunday, October 1st, we start up again our seasonal worship service called Tower Hill Nights. That's Sunday nights at 6 o'clock. We're going to be doing this service from October 1st till November 12th. And this is only the second time that we've tried it. And this is the first time we're actually inviting people outside the church to it. So if you're interested in a different kind of worship service, this is for you. It is even more casual than our casual service, if you can believe that. but you come and there's some music. It's very much like a coffee house. It's in our renovated space that we created for the teenagers called the Attic. And it's very relaxed. Everybody's hanging out and talking. There's a couple of songs. And then I do the same message live that I did Sunday morning, but there's also some conversation built around the message. So you get a chance to talk through some of the questions that come up, which is great because I think a lot of people really long for that opportunity to interact with the message, but don't get a chance to on Sunday morning. So this is an opportunity to do that. Again, we hope that you'll come out and be a part of Tower Hill Nights. If you know somebody who might be interested in that service, please let them know about it. And you can find all the details on our website, towerhillchurch.org. Also, that day happens to be Communion Sunday. Now, communion is only going to happen at the morning service, not the evening service, because I don't think we've really figured out how we're going to do that at that service yet. Again, this is a brand new thing that we've been doing. This is just our second time doing it, so we're figuring it out along with everyone else. But to more important things, and that is, have you been hearing God speaking to you? Maybe over the last week, maybe over the last months, not in an audible voice, but have you heard him speaking to your heart? Are there some areas of your life where you are feeling a holy discontent, as the preacher Bill Hybels used to call it, a holy discontent? Is there something that you feel just isn't quite right, and perhaps God is behind it? Perhaps God is showing you that he wants more for your life, for that area of your life, for this season of your life. And I pray that's what you find, and I hope that our podcast, our weekly messages, can help you to do that, help you to listen to God. And so we are going to jump into this week's message again. We are in a sermon series right now called The Gospel in Life. And this week, Pastor Julie brought us a really great sermon, really great message talking about idols. Idols. What are the idols that we worship, or the idols that tend to get in the way of our relationship with God? So let's take a listen. Here we go with Pastor Julie.
Well, good morning. I'm Pastor Julie, if I haven't met some of you. Today is the third week in our series called Gospel in Life. If you've been here the last couple of weeks, you've been following along. It's based on Tim Keller's book of the same title. And if you haven't been with us, I'll give a quick recap. On the first week, Pastor Jason talked about the world we live in, the city, and how we need to understand the context where God has placed us, and how we can live out the gospel here. Then last week, he talked about three different ways that we can live in this world based on the convictions of our heart. And the whole theme is sort of, how can we live out this gospel message in every area of our life, not just put our faith in a little faith box that doesn't intersect with all the rest of our lives. So this week, we're going to take another look at how the gospel changes our hearts as we look at the topic of idolatry. Idolatry? Heavy word. Idolatry, such a harsh and scary sounding word. What comes to mind when you hear that word, idolatry? Any images pop up in your mind? Perhaps you picture people bowing down to a golden calf or statues like some ancient people did in faraway countries. Well, I don't know anybody who bows down to golden statues of deities, but I do know that there are plenty of people who worship other gods. And what I mean by that is we put other things or other people before God. And anytime we make anything or any person more important than God and give it our primary energy and primary attention, it's idolatry, plain and simple. See, idolatry is not just something long, long ago from ancient people in faraway lands. It is alive and well today. It is right here in our midst. All you have to do is turn on the TV or look at a newspaper or radio and see that we give our primary attention and energy to all kinds of things other than God. Well, what makes idolatry even harder to recognize in ourselves is that our idols can be genuinely good things. They can be people that we love or things that are important to us, our jobs, our homes, our families, our physical fitness, our financial security. The problem begins is when those things that can be good in and of themselves, or those people, become the source of our primary identity or meaning or purpose in life. Maybe you've heard somebody say, my kids are my world, or my job is my life, or I have no life, all I do is work. That's sort of a clue that something might be a little off. I mean, work can become an idol if it causes us to ignore our families. Family can become an idol if we only are concerned about our own and no one else's. Being liked can be an idol if it becomes so important to us that we never risk doing or saying anything that might upset anyone. Even our faith can become an idol when we become so focused on our devotion to God that we miss everything else. We might even treat other people with scorn without even realizing it. We're thinking about our behavior, but no one else. Well, church reformer, who we have to thank for the Protestant Reformation, Martin Luther, said that whatever your heart clings to, that is your God. Anytime we worship and serve created things other than the Creator, it's idolatry. Whew, hard to hear that. Well, let's think back to the Ten Commandments. We all learned those at some point in our lives, right? If not, it's a good thing to do. You may recall when God gave Moses these Ten Commandments on Mount Sinai, Moses came down to tell the people of Israel what God had commanded, and there was thunder and lightning and a thick cloud of smoke and a blast of a trumpet, kind of signifying, pay attention, this is a big deal. So it's pretty important. You'd think it's something that we should remember, right? So I'm just curious, won't call you out, won't embarrass anybody, take a minute and try to think of how many of the Ten Commandments you can recall. You can scribble them on your bulletin, or you can use your fingers or toes or whatever you'd like. How many Ten Commandments, if this were the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire question, would you be able to name? How many Ten Commandments could you name? So take a minute, think. Okay, how many got stuck at about 4 or 5? Anyone? Okay. Good, then you're like 60% of Americans. According to Barna Research Group, the latest data says 60% of Americans cannot name even 5 of the commandments. So I won't ask us to rattle off all 10, but today we're going to look at just the first two because it really relates to what we're talking about here. I'll read a few first few verses of Exodus 20 in case you're wondering where to find the Ten Commandments. Third Exodus 20, also in Deuteronomy. Then God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. That's the first one. And the second one is, you shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that it is heaven or above, that is in the earth beneath. And then it goes on to say, you shall not bow down to them or worship them. So, no other gods before me, and do not make any idols and bow down to worship them. You see, our human hearts were made to worship. But the question is, will we worship God, or will we worship some created thing, which we call an idol? Martin Luther once wrote that all those who do not at all times trust God and do not in all their work or sufferings, life and death, trust in his favor, grace, and goodwill, but seek his favor in other things or in themselves, do not keep this commandment and practice real idolatry. And he goes on to say that even if they were to keep all the other commandments, which we can't remember, and pray and fast and obey and love others, it wouldn't matter because all of the other commandments rest on this one. So in other words, if you keep this first one, you're kind of obeying them all, but if you break this first one, the rest don't really matter. It is the most important. And the second commandment is pretty clear, do not make idols and worship them. Now, if you've convinced yourself that you don't have any idols, you might be tempted just to skip over this command. Oh, that just applies to those other people. But I think we need to pause and consider that we just might have some idols that we worship. Now, we may not consciously tell ourselves this, but if we're honest, I think that's what's going on. Now, of course, we know throughout the ancient world, people struggle with idol worship, and you may know the story where that golden calf image comes from when the Israelites got restless. They were tired of waiting for Moses. He was taking a really long time to come down from Mount Sinai. So his brother Aaron said, okay, everybody take off your jewelry, your rings, your gold chains, whatever you have, your bracelets, and we're going to melt it down, and this is going to be our God. Moses comes down from the mountain and sees his people carrying on and dancing and having a big festival and dancing around this statue, bringing it burnt offerings and sacrifices. Whew, not what he was expecting. They got tired of waiting, and they decided to create their own God. In the Psalms, we see continued condemnation of idols. The prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, condemn it even more strongly. And they reminded the people of Israel that their idols were made by human hands, not God's. That they were made in their image, not God's image. And that they really were worthless and had no power. Yet we know that idols can be quite powerful, enough to enslave us and control us, and almost compel our behavior. Well, in our culture today, we don't have an idol maker standing on the street corner making statues like the ancient Hebrews did. Our idols are much more subtle, and like I said, they can be good things. We can make an idol just by having thoughts about God that limit who God is. And of course, we may have an image of God, and Scripture is full of them. But the danger comes when we think that those images capture who God is. Years ago, I asked a confirmation class to each draw a picture of what they thought God looked like. You may not be shocked to find that I got lots of old Caucasian men with long beards and long white robes sitting in either a rocking chair or a throne. That was their image of who God was. Now, some people imagine something far more obscure, maybe someone or something far removed from us that gives us what we want, like a vending machine, if we're good, And that zaps us when we're bad. Again, not the complete image of God. Both of these images limit who God is and reflect what we want to see. I think this might be one of the reasons that some people did not embrace the movie The Shack, when God was portrayed as an African-American woman. In other words, Jesus was a Middle Eastern man and the Holy Spirit was an Asian woman. This didn't match the image of God that they had created in their minds. So that's the Old Testament. In the New Testament, it's a little different. Instead of things that we create, Apostle Paul talks about idolatry as inordinate desires, those yearnings and cravings and desires for things that we think will make us complete, that thing just out of reach, that promotion in the corner office, that bigger house, that vacation place, that lower number on the scale, whatever it is that we think is going to make us happy. Because you see, like those golden calf worshipers, we get restless and tired of worshiping an invisible God, so we create replacements of short-term security and comfort and pleasure. It could come from a bottle or a buffet or a bank account. Well, if you're still saying to yourself, idols, what idols? I don't have any idols. I invite you to ask yourself a few questions. That's what Tim Keller suggests to help us kind of zero in on what these idols might be in our lives. The first question he asks is, what is your biggest nightmare? What is it that if it were gone would make life not worth living? What is your biggest nightmare? Then he said, what do I do to feel better when life gets difficult? What is that thing? Could be an idol. And lastly, he says to ask yourself, what makes me proud? So think about your biggest nightmare. What do you do to feel better? And what are you proud of? Okay, so maybe, possibly, a few idols are coming to mind. Am I seeing Hannah? Could there be a physical object or an activity or a person or an image? Maybe something related to power or comfort or control or approval that comes to mind? If so, you're not alone. You're not alone. Well, hold on to that list of possible idols as we turn now to the Gospel of John, chapter 6, the story of the feeding of the 5,000. It is the only miracle found in all four Gospels, which tells us that it's important. Jesus gathers his 12 disciples. They've been exhausted after a long week of ministry. They need some rest to regroup. They want to recuperate. And this is what happens. After this, Jesus went to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, also called the Sea of Tiberias. A large crowd kept following him because they saw the signs that he was doing for the sick. Jesus went up the mountain and sat down there with his disciples. Now the Passover, the festival of the Jews, was near. When he looked up and saw a large crowd coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we going to buy bread for these people to eat?" He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he was going to do. Philip answered him, 6 months' wages would not be enough bread for each of them to get a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what are they among so many people?" Jesus said, "Make the people sit down." There was a great deal of grass in the place, so they sat down, about 5,000 in all. And Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. When they were satisfied, he told his disciples, "Gather up the fragments left over so that nothing may be lost. So they gathered them up, and from the fragments of the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten, they filled 12 baskets. Imagine Jesus looking down from the mountain while regrouping with his inner circle and sees this enormous crowd who has followed him, wanting his healing touch. Probably it was more like $15,000 or $20,000 people. People, when you count the women and children, because I think that 5,000 number does not include them. Anyway, Jesus is thinking ahead and thinking, these people are going to get hungry. They're going to want something to eat. So he wonders what his disciple Philip, who is likely chair of the finance committee, what he has in mind for feeding them all. And Jesus is kind of testing Philip, sort of stretching him a bit, and says, hey, Philip, where are we going to buy bread to feed all these people? Well, I don't think Jesus is expecting Philip to run down to Panera Bread and where they're going to ask him, do they want it sliced or toasted with butter or jelly for here to go? I mean, Philip can barely get his head around the numbers for buying the bread. And he's trying to do the numbers and pulls out his scratch pad and says, Lord, you know, according to my calculations, someone would have to work 6 months to pay these people. We just can't do this. You see, Philip was a realist. He sees very clearly what they could not do. This was in the budget. This is our resources. Sorry. They said, there's no way. Can't happen. Too many people. Not enough money. Not enough time. Not enough food. So sorry. Everybody will have to go home hungry to spend for themselves. We can't be responsible for all these people. Well, if we are anything like Philip, the realist, whenever we face something that seems to be impossible to us, say, not going to happen, too old, too out of shape, too this or that, don't know enough, or we focus only on what's missing, you know, not enough time, not enough money, not enough experience, when we do that, we don't leave enough room for God to inspire us with a new vision of what could be possible if we were only open to it. You see, Andrew had a vision. Found this boy with some food. Maybe he was there to sell it. Not sure. Thought, this is a solution. Wasn't much. I mean, Andrew talked himself out of the idea. I mean, you know, won't really make a dent, but okay, why not? But Jesus looks at what they had, what they had to work with, gives thanks, asks God to bless it. Next thing you know, everybody has enough. And there are 12 baskets of leftovers. We don't really know how Jesus fed all these people. We don't know if there was other people with bread and fish to share. We don't know if there was an underground bunker of food. We don't know if there was like an airdrop. We don't know. But you see, whenever Jesus performs a miracle, we always get stuck on how. How did he do that? Did he really make that blind man see? Did he really make that lame person walk? We get stuck on the how and the particulars. What we do know in this situation is that the disciples offered what they had in faith and that trusted God, their one true God, with the results, even when others looking on said, why bother? See, Philip had made self-sufficiency his God. Didn't leave room for God to provide. He was thinking about control, a nice and neat, tidy, orderly way of doing things. Not what God had in mind at all. Now, I suppose God could have worked a miracle without the boys' lunch. But besides the creation story, most times God doesn't create something out of nothing. Instead, God takes what we have and uses it to do his work. Uses our time, our talents, our money, and works through us. You see, when we don't see a way, God sees a way. God is a way maker, like we sang earlier. I've experienced this over and over in my life. Some of you have heard the story that when the associate pastor nominating committee first contacted me by email back in April, I think. I didn't see how it would be possible to move my family again 3 years after we had just relocated from Georgia to Pennsylvania. I was like, this is crazy. My husband Daniel had just started a new job the month before. So what did I do? I ignored their email. Well, anyone who knows me knows that I reply pretty quickly to messages, so this was very out of character for me. But this time, I just pretended I didn't see it. I just felt paralyzed. And then I thought, oh, big churches like that, they send hundreds of emails to people. They don't mean me. They, you know, they got like a whole list they're probably looking at. And it was so crazy, I didn't even tell my husband Daniel at first. I mean, it was out of the question. So we're not moving again, so why would I even bother him with that? I did tell him a few days later, and his response was similar. Seriously? New Jersey? We don't feel that way anymore. 2 weeks later, I got a call from Gordon Elan, the chair of the search committee, and thanks to the iPhone, I could see where the call was coming from, Red Bank, New Jersey, and knew instantly what the call would be about. And I was grocery shopping my daughter Ellie, so I didn't pick it up, let it go to voicemail, but as soon as I listened to the message, I called him back on my way home, and he started off by asking if I had received his email. Oh, yes, that email. Oh, yes, so sorry I didn't reply. Yes, I've been, busy. I don't know what I said. And I explained the reason a little bit for my hesitancy, lack of response, and told him about our family situation. And then when he asked if I'd be willing to talk with the search committee, I said words that I don't even remember thinking before they came out of my mouth. It's like they just, there they were. I think I said something like, I believe that God was bigger. You know, I told him that even though my husband just started a job, I believe that God was bigger than the obstacles I could see in front of me. And that if this was where God wanted me to be, then I needed to be open to this possibility. Then when I got home, I looked at the Tower Hill Church website. I think I read every single page. And after that, I told my husband, honey, I think this is exactly the kind of church we're looking for. And he had the same change of heart that I did. He said, let's be open to where this leads. God is bigger than our circumstances, and God has always provided for us. Well, looking back, I can see how I had made comfort and security my idols. I'd made approval by others an idol. See, there are plenty of people, well-meaning colleagues, who had all kinds of plans for my life. And there were family members who didn't understand why we continued to move to answer God's call. I'd given them way too much power and had a need for their approval. And when I think back about it, I realize that it's because I was afraid. I was afraid to imagine what God was up to. And afraid to even think about how God might include me in something that was greater than what I knew and bigger than what I could see. Have you ever done that? Have you ever found yourself afraid to imagine that God wanted to do something in and through you that was more than you could see, that was greater than you could imagine? See, when we look at our lives through God's eyes, we can see things, we can see abundance. We can see when there's enough for everyone. Instead of clinging to those gods of self-sufficiency and control and power, we can let go and say, God, what do you have in mind? How are you going to work in this situation? And then we begin to find peace and rest and the ability to share what we have with others. And we can finally let go of those idols that enslave us. Sure, we pick them up again. There's sort of a cycle. But when we remember that, we can let go. Well, in the situation I shared, when I finally remembered the goodness of God and recalled all the ways that God had provided for us in the past, I stopped being afraid. And I could ignore the critics. And then one by one, all the pieces began to fall into place. Home and school and all the things, a place for Daniel to stay, a few nights in Philadelphia so he didn't have to commute every day. I mean, all these things just sort of do-do-do-do-do. So now you know a little bit more about me and the idols that I've wrestled with in my life. And now maybe you have a better sense of possible idols in your life. Maybe you've seen some things in a new way. The question you might be asking yourself is, well, what do I do about it? What do I do now that I have maybe identified some of these things that have become idolatrous in my life? Well, last Sunday, Jason talked about three ways to live, a religious way, an irreligious way, and a gospel way. In a similar vein, I'm going to suggest three ways you can respond to idols, and they're not all equally valid options, but there are three ways that people do respond to idols. First way you can respond to idol is change your behavior. Just, you know, stop doing whatever you're doing. Stop drinking, stop overspending, stop overeating, just stop. Well, if you've ever tried that with any other addiction in your life, it's not very effective. It doesn't ever get to the reason for the behavior. It doesn't ask why. Another way you could respond to idols is to change your thinking. If you just remember that God loves you, then you won't act this way. So you just have to change your thoughts. Again, not so helpful. It doesn't ask why. It doesn't help you understand why sometimes you feel like a failure or why you get angry or anxious and certain things happen, even though you know that God loves you. We need to go deeper. And that brings a third way, which I believe is the best way. And that is to change your passion. Change that reason for living, that framework, that guide, that thing that drives who you are and how you make decisions. Instead of looking for other things to make you happy, look to Christ, who can break the power that the idols have over us, who can set us free from whatever enslaves us. So what does that look like? Three R words. Preachers always love words that rhyme and start with the same letter. The first is to repent, which is another scary word, but all it means is turn around. Turn away from those things that have been enslaving you. Go in a different direction. The second is to rejoice in the love of Christ, that is saving work. Give thanks to what Jesus provides that is far greater than what that idol can provide. And to rejoice in who God is. Pour out your praise like we sang earlier. And then to rest. Rest in that truth that you know, that Jesus can quench whatever thirst we have, can feed whatever hunger we have, and can truly satisfy our restless hearts. Well, maybe your examples of what controls you and keeps you up at night looks much different than mine. But whatever you figure out what they are, name them, confess them, dethrone them, turn away from them, and remember how Christ gives us so much more than any of these idols can give us.